From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. In today's dialogue, we'll be speaking with experts about local efforts on Black mental health and wellness in Illinois.
That event changed my life forever in the sense of my personal life as well as my professional life.
Black Americans often shield who they really are in the workplace, and that means having to hide your culture.
We're being more open about it. We're talking about it. There are more resources now than there have been ever been before.
In this conversation, you'll be hearing from Anjanette Young, a survivor of police cruelty. She tells us why the incident strengthened her to help other victims of trauma. Later on, I went to the first Black-owned barber academy in Champaign, a cut above the rest. It was founded by Carlos Harvey. He tells us more about life after prison and giving others promise within their own purpose.
When I came home, I seen a lot of hopelessness and a lot of people losing hope, so I figured with the skill and gift that I have, you know, I can inspire some people by, you know, working for themselves.
Brittany Walker, a licensed clinical social worker, breaks down the 10 most common side effects of having to hide yourself and your culture in the workplace.
Burnout is real. Stress kills. I feel like there are some things that are just out of our control. You can't control the environment of the workplace, but you can control the way you respond to it. It's not an even playing field. That's the difference for Black professionals living by different standards.
I spoke with her on this culture reset and what authenticity in the workplace looks like for African Americans. We spoke about the culture grind of proving yourself in the workplace and what it's like being a Black professional in 2024. Thank you so much for joining me in this conversation.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Being Black in the workplace, questioning your worth, questioning your value to the workplace, a lot of people could relate that that happens way more than we would like.
Oh, yeah.
Dive into that, questioning your worth being Black in the workplace.
So not being able to see many that look like you. That can be taxing to your just well-being in general. Not feeling like you're seen or heard or valued. As simple as not being able to talk to others about what you're experiencing is huge. I've noticed and have heard from clients tell me that they feel like it's added pressure to overperform. So it goes back to not feeling valued, but also trying to prove yourself. These are the common factors of burnout for Black professionals. Racial discrimination and microaggressions, representation, lack of representation, isolation, the mental health stigma, lack of mentorship and sponsorship, tokenism, cultural taxation, workload and undercompensation, pressure to succeed, and organizational inequalities.
So Black employees often carry the weight of their lived experiences and societal traumas into the workplace, unfortunately. What is 2024 saying about employers just creating an environment? You know, we have the rise of DEI and there's kind of these buzzwords, diversity, hire. What are these environments even looking like today and supporting this reality kind of around these buzzwords being shaped?
Honestly, I think that is something that is still in progress. I still feel like it's lacking. Of course, some spaces, they do have the DEI to support us. But even that is lacking because most of the people that are on the committee or part of those groups are white. And that's another thing, too, that ties into the cultural taxation of not only is there pressure of taking on your workload, but then also because you are maybe only the one person or maybe few out the bunch, they want you to be a part of the group, but it's kind of hard to do that when there's so many of your white counterparts. It's almost like you feel like you have to like teach cultural competency. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much like what you're doing in those spaces. But even that can be uncomfortable because you're like representing, like I said, the entire Black race.
Well, it's not true.
And it's not true. It's something that is still in progress. From what I've heard from clients, in some spaces, it really doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. It's more of paper compliant. Like, yes, we have a space for you. We have a space where we include everyone. There's diversity, but really it's not.
How does the experience of burnout differ for Black professionals compared to non-Black colleagues?
I would say it differs because for white counterparts, they have the emotional capacity and physical space to be able to say that they're not okay. That is something I hear all the time. I've experienced it myself. There's so many other factors too. There's cultural factors. I mean, if we really want to throw the elephant on the table, privilege. My friends and I will make jokes sometime and say, it's okay if Caitlin is having a crisis because that's something that is normal. It's okay for her to be able to cry. She will have someone to console her because growing up, that was something you didn't think about. Mm-hmm. It was something that she didn't have to think about. And it will be humanistic. It will be normal. She could express herself and then she will be able to get the support she needs because there were certain things in the household that were taught to her that this is what you say, this is what you do. These are opportunities that you have. On the flip side, then you have Tiffany. Tiffany was taught to be strong. Tiffany was taught that you can't show weakness. You have to be 10 steps ahead. You can't show that you're not okay. So Tiffany's putting on a face. She's enduring more stress than she needs to. Also, as a tie to another common factor that I mentioned, there's still a stigma around mental health in the Black community, unfortunately. And so going to therapy is not an option or is frowned upon. And so if Tiffany goes to work and says that she's not okay, then her competency is questioned. Can you really do the work? If there's a fear of if she is overly expressive or it gets emotional, then it's unprofessional. I think that's the difference of just for Black professionals living by different standards. It's not an even playing field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does balance and boundaries go hand in hand? If someone is struggling with finding what this balance looks like for themselves, mm-hmm. or they're just a bit jaded, right? Because we're all going through it in our own corner of the world. Mm-hmm. What does balance not only look like, but what would be your advice to just creating some balance in your life?
I think it starts as simple as looking at what does your daily routine look like. I always suggest to my clients to set intentions for the day. Like if you don't know what that looks like, then how do you want to feel? So if you're all over the place and you feel like you're all over the place, how do you not feel all over the place? A lot of times I help clients to identify words with feelings. So if they feel all over the place, like, okay, so what would be the opposite of that? Peace. How do you create that? That's where you would really start, is looking at how you interact in the world in general and discover how you would like to feel. What do you need to create that new normal? So whether that is establishing a bedtime, that's creating healthy boundaries. If I say, hey, Kennedy, my bedtime is 9:30 which I'm working on it, then I should be in the bed or have on my pajamas, you know, getting ready, the night routine, you know, knowing I shouldn't be answering calls. 9:30 is a reason why I need to be in bed at 9:30. When you get up, sometimes people feel like they're rushing and they're brushing their teeth in the car and they're eating while they're, you know, doing so many things. And I talk to my clients about this in terms of like practicing like mindfulness activities, being present. And that's another thing. When you're all over the place and there's an imbalance, somewhere in that we're not being present. I mean, as simple as like establishing your daily routine, I think it starts there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When you're in the workplace and you're navigating the workplace stressors, how do you navigate the challenges without compromising your authentic self, right? Because you mentioned earlier, you're at times teaching cultural competency, or you're just showing up more than others. How can you still show up as who you are, in the essence of who you are, but navigating the workplace environment?
It feels like you have to be two different people, but play the same role. And so when we say show up as our authentic selves, that goes with like the physical. So with hair, your outer appearance in terms of clothes, but then also too, how to hold on to like your values, even if like some of your principles do not align with the company's principles. How to stay true to yourself, that's very challenging. I think it goes back to remembering your why, of why or what brought you to that particular profession, why the particular company, why are you doing these things, but then also your future goals too, because sometimes that can help too. There are so many ways to still be yourself without losing yourself in a job. And I think that's something that does not stop self-discovery. I don't believe that you should compromise your values. And I say this is a hard question because sometimes it may require you to remove yourself in order to stay professional. Or if you know there are certain environments in the workplace that you shouldn't be in or you don't have to be in, or maybe you can just limit yourself to a particular space and environment, that's a way of not compromising your values.
How can allies and organizations take meaningful action to really support and to hold space for Black professionals and working towards creating a more equitable workplace that is just reducing the risks of our burnout?
I think number one is actually acknowledging that there is a problem, which is very uncomfortable, especially white counterpart allies. Like, I think it's important for them to understand what are the workplace disparities as it pertains to the lack of cultural competencies and also like resources. Having these hard conversations to address the needs, you have to know like exactly what the need is in order to support. The environment has to be like safe enough to do it. You know, when it's more, of course, like more numbers, we can get more things accomplished. But the conversations have to start. And it's really hard when you have Black professionals in general that are not even comfortable in talking about the disparities in pay, the lack of opportunities for advancement. I think that it has to be addressed first that there is a problem before we can actually figure out what the solution is to the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there should be more resources around therapy, like really promoting having a space to talk about some of these things. Even maybe like having a mental health consultant come out and facilitate some of these discussions. But yeah, I think the first thing is just acknowledging that there's a problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I really think it's imperative that we as like a Black community like really break the barriers down when it comes the stigma around mental health and getting help, because burnout is real. It's real. Stress, it kills. It definitely does. And it's something, I feel like there are some things that are just out of our control. You can't control the environment of the workplace, but you can control the way you respond to it. And for that, you need support. I think that's one thing, like for me, when I see someone during the initial therapy session, I always ask about what does your home environment look like and support system look like, but what does a work environment look like? Because that takes a toll. We spend most of our time at work, and so it's important for us to take care of ourselves. I think I would highly suggest, you know, to Black professionals that are on the fence about therapy or just feel like, okay, I'm not ready for that, like to really consider, if you're not ready for therapy, consider maybe joining a support group or some, or having some form of community, finding some form of community as an outlet. Because if not, it's so taxing. I hear all the time, I don't have the capacity, I don't have the space to not be okay. You know, if I blow up on someone, it's going to be interpreted as I'm aggressive or angry. And I would rather just not say anything. But I think not saying anything contributes to like the problem that we were talking about.
Thank you so much, Brittany, for coming on and giving us the knowledge and wisdom on how we can handle burnout and advocate for ourselves.
Thank you for having me.
That was Brittany Walker. She's a licensed clinical social worker in Champaign and Urbana. Up next, back in 2019, Angela Young's home was wrongfully raided by Chicago police.
Just see them walking around my house feeling humiliated.
Angela shares how she healed from the trauma and her community efforts to help others do the same. Stay with us after this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. In this dialogue, we're speaking with Illinoisans on local Black mental health and wellness spaces in our community. Joining the conversation now is Anjanette Young. She's a survivor, social worker, and founder of Cafe Social Work. She started Cafe Social Work after a horrific event in 2019 when her home was wrongfully raided by Chicago police. Before Anjanette Young joins the conversation, here is a news clip story on what happened to her back in 2019.
On a pattern of wrong raids by Chicago police.
Story of Anjanette Young. We were later the first to expose the shocking video of the botched raid.
Naked and handcuffed in her own home. A licensed clinical social worker humiliated and scarred when Chicago police raided the wrong home.
It was 7 p.m. and police officers were executing a search warrant in the wrong home.
I had my hands up and they were yelling at me, "We have a warrant for this home."
Police were acting on a vague tip about a 23-year-old man who a confidential informant claimed had a handgun and ammunition. Police were supposed to be across the street, inside this building. Instead, they burst into Anjanette's home, and she says they did it right at the moment she was changing her clothes and was completely naked.
I just can remember just crying and yelling, like, "Please let me put clothes on."
They didn't, but they did give her handcuffs.
This is a person. This is a female being exposed. And I just cried.
What do you see?
I could just see them walking around my house and, you know, and feeling like, feeling humiliated.
These people are treated less than human.
I thought they were gonna shoot me. I really thought they were gonna shoot me.
Anjanette Young was awarded $2.9 million from Chicago police. Young said in subsequent interviews that the money does not equate to the injustice that she endured, and she just wanted all 12 policemen to be fired from Chicago PD. In October of 2024, Anjanette Young was the keynote speaker at the second annual Black Mental Health and Wellness Conference at Parkland College. This year, the conference delved into a deeper understanding of mental health in the Black community. Anjanette Young now joins me in conversation. Anjanette Young, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to spend time with you this morning.
In 2019, Chicago Police Department wrongfully raided your home, and it was in a moment that went viral across the country. How has that experience reaffirmed your commitment to the work that you're doing today and continuing to be a social worker?
That event changed my life forever, in the sense of my personal life as well as my professional life. Before then, I'd been a social worker for 20 plus years, really enjoy working with children and families. And primarily my work was direct practice. I was working in different social service organizations, working directly with families, you know, on different social issues that the family may have been experiencing. Once the raid happened in 2019, my idea of social work changed completely, in the sense that advocacy has always been a part of social work. It just had never been a part of my professional social work career. And so after going through my healing journey and really seeing a need for advocating for what had happened to me to not happen to other families, you know, during my legal case, I learned of all of these different families that was having the same experiences that I had had. However, those families weren't receiving justice from the city of Chicago, and for different reasons, those families were not able to speak out in the same way that I have become able to speak out.
You had the courage and the strength to start CAFE Social Work in efforts to increase the number of minority and underrepresented groups in the social work field. And according to some recent numbers, the National Association of Social Workers reported that only 22% of new social workers are African American and 14% are Hispanic and Latino. What do these efforts look like to you and what you're seeing today? And what are some of the systemic barriers that people may experience as they're entering the social work field?
Well, the reason I started CAFE Social Work, and it's so, the trajectory is so interesting. I was already in the process of starting CAFE Social Work before the raid happened. Literally, at the time that the raid happened, I was planning my lunch party for March 16th of 2019. And the raid happens on February 21st, 2019. So literally weeks away from me launching my business. And so it was really difficult for me to manage through that, but there was just a passion in me. Like, I didn't want the raid and what had happened to me in the raid derail my plans of starting my organization, because it had been months in the planning. And so I moved forward even in the midst of all of my trauma. I like to say I muddled through it, right? I just kind of pushed through it and made it happen. But my reason for that is understanding throughout my work of social work, I've learned and I've seen that individuals who are in most need of a social worker in the areas of foster care, in the areas of addiction, in areas of homelessness, those families who were who are in need of, you know, social work assistance, we're not having social workers that look like them, or we're coming from their community, their culture. And so it's hard to, for a family who's in need to really be vulnerable and open up to what the need is when the person on the other side of the table does not look like them. Mm-hmm. And so with my organization, with me starting Cafe Social Work, I wanted to give new social workers an opportunity to be in those spaces. I wanted to do my part to increase those numbers so that the families that I was seeing on a regular basis were starting to see social workers that look more like them.
Not only are you doing this work with people who want to get into the field, but you speak to groups all across the country. And now you recently spoke at the second annual Black Mental Health and Wellness Conference in Champaign as a keynote speaker. What are some of the topics you discuss that really resonate most with people?
During the conference, I really wanted to convey the importance of mental health in Black America, and how it's seen in our Black communities. In the sense that oftentimes in the Black community, you know, mental health looks like anxiety and depression or community trauma that's not always seen as a mental illness. And so helping at the conference, helping individuals to understand that mental illness goes beyond some of the really hard things that we hear about, like the bipolar and the schizophrenia. That everyday traumas, everyday stressors is a part of your mental health. Everyday stressors is, it's important to identify those things that, you know, the lack of childcare can be a stressor for a single parent who's trying to get to work every day. Food insecurities, food deserts, those things also very much cause stressors in our lives that is a part of our mental health and our mental wellness.
Why are these conferences so important?
It's important because we're in a time in our world right now where mental health is a buzzword, right? Everybody's saying it. Everybody seems to have some type of focus on it. What I shared at the conference is that this is nothing new. Mental health, and especially in the Black and brown communities, what's new is that now we're in a position where we're being more open about it. Mm-hmm. We're talking about it. There are more resources now than there have been ever been before. The resources are still not as efficient as we would like them to be, but there are more now than there were, I would say, 10, 15 years ago. And I think that COVID was a huge turning point for a lot of people around mental health and mental illness because it forced us to deal with things that we were hiding just by being able to get out and do our everyday and our everyday lives. So we were moving about our everyday lives and hiding behind the things that were very hard for us. And then COVID shuts everything down. And now we're at home and we're forced to deal with those issues. Now families, you know, husband and wives who have been struggling are now forced to be in the household together and deal with life, where children who had lots of issues that the parents weren't seeing because children are at school, mom and dad is at work, and, you know, they're just kind of ships passing in the night. COVID shuts things down, and now the family has to deal with those underlying issues that have always been there. And so COVID was kind of a blessing in disguise, as in it forced us to deal with some of the mental health things that were already in our lives.
Absolutely. How do you take care of your own mental health and wellness? What would your advice be to other African Americans, whether it's being a part of a marginalized group and you want to get into social work, or being a public figure, or if you've been traumatized by the police in this country?
Yeah, that's a real tricky question. There's no one right answer, I would like to say. There are multiple things that I do in my life to kind of balance my mental wellness. I tell people all the time that, you know, I am a woman of faith. So my faith and my spirituality is a strong part of my mental wellness. But also I have a therapist. The really great thing is I was connected with a therapist before the 2019 raid happened, which made it that much more easier for me to connect around that trauma. Now, understanding that my situation looks a little different than other people who experience a severe trauma the way I did on February 21st, 2019. I mean, oftentimes you don't know what to do after something like that happens, where to go or who to seek out for help, or even to understand that there is help available to you because of that. Now, because of my social work background, and if I was already connected to a therapist because I understood the need to and the importance of having a therapist to help me balance out the stressful life of being a social worker, I was able to call my therapist the very next day and say, this happened to me and I need to come in right away. Oftentimes when people make the decision to seek out therapy, they run into barriers of connectiveness, right? Do they have the right insurance? Where do I go? Finding a therapist that looks like me or finding a therapist that relates to my situation. And so sometimes it takes 3 to 6 months to really get connected to a therapist. Because I was already connected, that eliminated that barrier for me. And so I was able to get in and see my therapist right away. So I would say to people who are wondering, like, what do I do or how do I manage this thing of mental wellness? I would say first identifying and being vulnerable and transparent with people that you trust that you have something going on. Right? We can't live in silos or refuse to share things that are hard for us. And we need to move away from stigma and the taboo of going to therapy in the Black community and be vulnerable enough to say, I am not okay. And sharing that with someone that you don't have the answers to why you're not okay, but let's get you connected to someone that can help you process through that.
Anjanette Young, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation. Thank you for all the incredible work that you're doing in our community today.
Thank you.
That was Anjanette Young. She's a social worker and founder of Cafe Social Work. Up next, you'll be hearing from a Parkland College mental health conference.
You never want to control your emotions because we all have emotions and they're neither good or bad. It's just how we respond to them.
And then the first Black-owned barber academy in Champaign.
When I came home, I seen a lot of hopelessness and a lot of people losing hope. So I figured with the skill and gift that I have, you know, I can inspire some people by, you know, working for themselves.
Stay with us on Dialogue after this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture. Straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. Today, we're speaking with Illinoisans on local Black mental health and wellness initiatives within our community. Donna Tanner Harold is an event organizer for the Black Mental Health and Wellness Conference at Parkland College. She's a retired faculty counselor at Parkland, and she wanted to create a space for healing in her community. This year, it was the second annual Black Mental Health and Wellness Conference in October of 2024. And Harold says she's hoping there will be many more to come in the future. Donna Tanner Harold, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation.
Thank you for having me today.
It's the second annual Black Mental Health and Wellness Conference in Champaign. Tell us a bit about the conference.
Well, last year, I did a series of workshops throughout the community about Black mental health and wellness. And the reception was very positive. And people were asking, can we get together? Can we do this again? We need to maybe have more of it. And so I took the idea to the Champaign Community Coalition and they were very supportive of it. And we got together and we planned workshops and had a luncheon and a guest speaker, and it went over so well, we decided to do it again.
And like you said, last year you were doing different things around the community, but it was also the first year of the conference. And I was reading that it aimed to dispel stigmas. So what's the goal for this year?
The goal for this year, I believe, is to just continue collaborating and informing people about mental health and wellness, emphasizing that mental health is a part of wellness, just like we have a measure of physical health that we need to maintain. We also need to maintain a really positive sense of mental health. And I'm a licensed clinical professional counselor, and I've done this for a long time. It's very important for me to help people to understand that having limitations, we all do, is not a bad thing. We just need to recognize it and to know when we need to reach out and to get help.
Absolutely. So tell us a bit about a positive mental health. What does that look like? What does that feel like?
A positive mental health, if you think about our emotions, and you never want to control your emotions because we all have emotions and they're neither good or bad. It's just how we respond to them. And the way it helps us to make decisions in life and helps us to our sense of confidence, how we feel about ourselves, how we look at life. And when we all go through bad times, I guess I would say, we all get a bit anxious about things. We all have times where we're sad or depressed or confused or frustrated. And we have to have good coping skills so that we can make those good decisions, have good relationships. And really positive mental health is important because then it determines really our kind of our destiny in life in terms of the expectations and the limitations we put on ourselves.
And after you retired, you started this conference. Why was Parkland the right host for this conference?
Well, as a counselor, I worked remotely during the pandemic. And when we returned to campus, I saw our department, the Counseling Support Center, saw an increase in Black students coming to counseling, our center, for support. It's not that they had never come before, but they came, there was an increased number, and that was due to the isolation, the loneliness, the things that they had experienced during the pandemic. And it was just really, really gratifying to see them come and to be able to work through some of the things in spite of the stigma and maybe some of the fears that some students have. And so my supervisor at the time, Stephanie DeVingman, was very, very positive about the increase. And when I talked to her about the conference, she said, well, I'll work with you. I'd love to have Parkland sponsors. So that's really how it came about being at Parkland.
Would you say that when you were seeing kind of that uptick within African-American students looking for help or just looking for different avenues in a way to express themselves or just say what they were going through, was that a bit of the inspiration for the conference as well?
Well, there was a bit of inspiration for the workshops and the presentations that I did, which in turn then kind of inspired the conference. So yes, I guess I would say that. Well, just seeing the loneliness and the disconnect, not only in students and young people, but also just throughout the community, older people, people who never really maybe fit in, sort of. They were looking for, how do we find that kind of support system? What do we do? How do we support ourselves? How do we support each other? So it was kind of lots of things that went into it.
Yeah, definitely. Could you tell other listeners some of the things that you're hoping for in the next few years or what they can expect when they're attending the conference in future years?
I want the conference to continue because I think it's a good collaboration of organizations and partners in the community to continue to educate not only just Black community members, but our whole community on what it takes to be strong and healthy and have good mental health. And I think that would encourage us all to be better people. And if we're all better individually, then we're going to be better collectively.
Definitely.
Even if you don't come to the conference, you can reach out to me or reach out to me through you, maybe even your station, mm-hmm. and give us suggestions on what you would like to see. Maybe we try to have a really well-rounded agenda for the day, but obviously we can't cover everything. And if there are things that people would like to see us cover, then we're certainly open to discussing that. I really look forward to making this an event where people can continue to educate themselves and to break down these barriers and the stigmas.
Thank you so much for having this conversation with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Carlos Harvey now joins the conversation. He's the founder of the first Black-owned barber academy in Champaign and Urbana, a cut above the rest.
When Harvey was formally incarcerated, he was taking a business class. He had to create a business plan, and that is how A Cut Above the Rest first started. I went to the Barber Academy and sat down with Carlos Harvey. He told me how the Barber Academy is a hub for Black mental health and wellness, and how he works with other individuals who are in reentry. What first inspired you to open the Barber Academy?
Well, like I say, I was incarcerated myself back in 2008. I got out in 2014. While I was in, I was taking a lot of college courses. I accumulated like 41 credit hours, and I was in a business management course. And on our last day, professor was pretty much just telling us not to go home and start a business, just to start one, find out what our community needs. And the Holy Spirit spoke to me and told me Barber College. And that's where the idea really popped up, came from. So from that day forward, that's where I've just been, you know, reading, doing a lot of research, and how prevalent is the barber industry, which is a $58 to $60 billion industry right now. So, and when I came home, I seen a lot of hopelessness and a lot of people losing hope. So I figure, with the skill and gift that I have, you know, I can inspire some people by, you know, working for themselves.
You briefly spoke about what it was like when you first started the Barber Academy and you felt that something was missing in the community. What did you feel like was missing in the community?
A lot of hopelessness, a lot of people arguing, fussing, and fighting. I heard a lot of arguing, fussing, and fighting about petty money. I mean, I think if your income is doing a lot better than most, I don't think you would be putting yourself in those type of positions. So I just wanted to come in and help in that manner right there. You know, make people feel good, right? Feel worthy, get their value back to themselves. Maybe they can stop, you know, wanting to harm somebody else, right?
What was your journey as a barber before you opened up the academy?
So I started out at the age of 13, cutting in my mom's kitchen, and then my bedroom, and then the basement. From 13, I went to, after high school, I went to cosmetology school, and I graduated the most promising to succeed out of that. And then I went on to, that's when I got incarcerated. After I got done with my time, I went to work release up in Peoria, Illinois, and went on to renew my license. And the rest is history.
How do you hope Black men can find mentorship in attending the Barber Academy? And how do you see this place adding to our community?
Well, another piece to the Barber Academy, I partnered with another guy in this community named Jeremy Smith. And he works for the Baby Fold. And basically, he's a social worker. And once a month, we do daddy dialogues over here. So it's basically a mental health piece that speaks about the importance of fathers in the homes, or just being present, right? So I invite all the students. Pretty much we teach life skills over here with different workshops. I bring different professionals from the community to come in and teach workshops. So basically just want to give them life skills. Not only are they coming here to cut hair, learn how to cut hair, but we teach them how to be an entrepreneur, but along with the life skills that's going to take to keep being the entrepreneur that they dream to be, right? So that's pretty much it. Just try to surround them with all the knowledge that we can provide. With the knowledge, you get an understanding. With understanding, you can apply it, right? And better change your life. So when you have more information, you have more choices. You're giving yourself a choice, right? So that's how we pretty much try to help everybody from, you know, just listening to them. Like the students here, I have them journal. And I want to find out what's going on inside of their heads, where I can find out what's the best way I can help them, right?
So what's another component to, you said daddy dialogue, talking about your mental health and overall Black wellness in our community?
I just pretty much try to connect with all the other Black organizations in the community. Where is the need? Like I said, as a barber, you hear everything from, I mean, all types of stories, right? So people in need, right? So by this being a hub, the barbershop being a hub, I pretty much just provide resources to folks. So pretty much a consultant, really, right?
What would be your advice, your hope, your inspiration for other Black men who are still finding their way and still finding themselves?
First, start by looking in the mirror and asking themselves, What is it that they want to do? What is their purpose? And just start, just get on that journey and start finding out, you know, do a lot of self-help. Exercise, diet, right? More reading. I think, the more we become knowledgeable, the more we understand. When you understand, you know how to apply. So those are the three keys that I use to get in any door that I want to get into in life. Knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. Most of all, the application is the wisdom, right? And that's it, just educating the mind. You know, it's a muscle and it has to be tapped into. And if you don't use it, you'll lose it, right? So I have a library here for the kids. I've sat in a couple classes in elementary schools and I found out that they don't make them stand up and read anymore. And you'll lose your voice like that. So we pretty much get them in here. Sometimes we ask them to read to the barbers as they getting their hair cut. Might give them a couple dollars for doing it. But education is the piece that really helped me. I wanted to find out why was I doing what I was doing to get incarcerated. So I started tapping into the psychology, right? Study of oneself, one's behavior. And that's pretty much it. I mean, I'm a big advocate of going to sit down with a therapist, right? Unload some baggage that no child should carry for the rest of their life, right? So that's pretty much what that daddy dialogue piece is about too. And parenting doesn't come with a informational handbook, but we do, we go through things and you learn from those things. You can either let it beat you or you can help it, you can use it to let it grow, make grow you, right? But the mental health, the therapy piece, I think that's the biggest advocacy piece I can give to another black man. To study oneself and find out what it is, you know, that you would like to do. Just start dreaming. And if you can see it, you can be it.
Briefly paint a picture of what it felt like seeing your graduates, the first graduating class from the Barber Academy on Saturday. How did that feel? What did it look like for yourself and for your students? And then also for someone who may want to come to your academy, what can they expect? And talk about after graduating, like what's next for your first graduating class?
Saturday was it was a little bit overwhelming, but it was great just to hear the testimonies. Each one wrote a bio about their experience here, right? So just to hear the stories and the all the appreciation for the love that I've been showing them. You know, what I just told you, I just surround them around different professionals from the community to help them in their journey. And to hear those stories, man, that was empowering, that was inspiring for me to keep going and keep helping, right? Our first graduating class, we had a 100% graduation rate. No one quit. Everybody finished the whole journey, 9 months. What I could tell someone is what you expect is just to learn how to receive love. You know, I pray before I come in the door every day. I pray for a comfortable atmosphere, a peaceful atmosphere, just to come in and just want to learn and want to do better, right? And this is the place for it. So that's my piece that I use. That's the piece that I use to go a cut above the rest of everybody else, right? I can easily call you in for a haircut, but I want to give you a little bit more. All right, so that's pretty much it.
Carlos Harvey, thank you for having this conversation with me.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me. Though.
You can find the Dialogue podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. And you can give us a follow on Instagram and Facebook at Illinois Soul. This episode of Dialogue was produced by Zainab Qureshi, Troy McDonald, and myself, Kennedy Vincent. Our news and public affairs director is Reginald Hardwick, and production assistance by Steve Mork. Dialogue is a part of Illinois Soul and Illinois Public Media. Join us for our next Dialogue every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and Tuesday night at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul FM 101.1 and WILL AM 580 Wednesdays at 8 p.m.